the sugya up until the next Mishnah today, and we basically have three more sugyos of Gemara remaining to learn. There's one very small sugya about the identity, the anatomical and other characteristics of the chilazon from which tcheles is manufactured. Then there's a long story about a person who was rescued from a tremendous sin in the merit of his fulfillment of the mitzvah of tzitzis, and then he got tremendous reward for utilizing the inspiration that tzitzis provided him with in order to avoid that sin. And then finally, there's a last chapter, a last sugya, which counts up the number of mitzvos that one fulfills when he has a mezuzah or a tzitzis or a tefillin, or birkas kohanim for that matter, and things like that. And so we may even cover all three of these today between the two shiurim, as long as we start promptly, so let's do that. Mem Dalet Amud Aleph, third word. Just wait for everyone to. Just tomorrow. Yeah, tomorrow is the Siyum. Whatever that will be.
So the Hertzberg is first year on Thursday.
Yeah, so I'm not going to be here Thursday. I have a meeting.
Wednesday, Thursday,
Siyum. Tomorrow.
I'm not planning to bring in food. It'll be a siyum of Divrei Torah. Maybe we'll sing something.
Fried chicken or cake?
So, Yes, Rabbi. Donuts? We should bring in donuts?
No. We have enough calories as it is.
We should bring hair.
Oh, that's just for you. The smell will kill me.
Oh, maybe I will bring in some food. Okay, we'll see.
Yeah.
Tanu Rabbanon. Chilazon. Chilazon Zeh. This chilazon. Gufo Dome Layam. Its body resembles the ocean. Anyone want to clarify what that means?
It's color.
It's color. Okay. What does the word Tavnis mean?
It's shape.
So Rashi, if you look at Rashi for a second, the third line of Rashi, Dibra Maschil Gufo, Rashi says something very interesting here. Mare Gufo Tavnis Diukno. So Mare Gufo might mean a color, right? A Mare very often means a color, but a tavnit means a shape. So which one is it? Is it the color of the chilazon, the shape of the chilazon that resembles the ocean? And what's a diukan?
Diukno is
profile.
No, face, right? Diukno shel aviv. Remember
the shape of its body. There's a lot of uncertainty that's involved. What does it mean that it is similar to the ocean? Let's take a look at the next characteristic. See whether it's any more clear. B'riyaso dome l'dog. Its bria resembles a fish. What is a bria? We said a guf is a body, right? A mara is a color, a tavnit is a shape. What's a bria?
Bria is a creation.
Its creation resembles a fish. So here I'll tell you that technically speaking, when the Gemara uses the word bria, it means to talk about something that metamorphoses over the course of its lifetime. That's usually how the Gemara uses the word bria, and then it's by way of contrast. It initially, when it's first created, when it first comes into existence, it may have one form, but later on, it loses that form and takes on a different form, in which case, briato domeh ledag, right, would actually be two characteristics. Number one, that when it comes into existence, it resembles a fish, but perhaps at some later point in its life cycle, it ceases to resemble a fish.
And it's so amphibian. That's really what the key was.
Second one.
It's
amphibian. It can go in the. It it's like a seal. It can be in the water and then it goes out.
Wait, so you are, so what does it mean then when it's created it resembles a fish?
Because it, in the beginning it started a fish, and then when it metamorphoses it becomes a snail.
But amphibians don't metamorphose. Amphibians are born amphibious. Right? So you know, you might want to say that perhaps this is a type of amphibian which is always born in the water. Yeah. Right? So the first moment that it's born, it's like a fish in as much as it's underwater. But then, as early as a few minutes into its life, you would want to say, perhaps it could already come out of the water. Okay, that could be. It's not necessarily how I would usually interpret Briasso. Usually I would interpret Briasso as that it undergoes a genuine metamorphosis and not simply a change in its habitat.
And it's not a couple of seconds, it's 70 years. It's 70 years to get out.
Okay. The Ola Echa L'Shivim Shana. And it comes up once every 70 years. They're saying that these particular amphibians live most of their lives or all of their lives underwater. That's what you want to say. So you're saying that Doma L'Dag and Ola Echa L'Shivim Shana are really the same description, the same characteristic. What does Rashi say? Ola min ha'aretz. Ooh, that could be a problem. It comes up from the ground, not from underwater. So that's basically all that I want to say. There's a lot of uncertainty about what exactly are the characteristics of the chilazon. I did not have a chance, as I indicated last week, to do the anatomical, zoological research to actually, you know, find out, you know, aside from the fact that there's other places where Rashi comments on this Gemara also, where he gives other, perhaps conflicting definitions or interpretations of the characteristics listed by this Gemara. And even leaving that aside, the task of matching the characteristics that are described by the Gemara and by the Rishonim with the, and you know, the particular features of a snail or of something else is a very, very large task. So we'll just leave it at that there is a lot of uncertainty in even just how to interpret the characteristics which the Gemara ascribes to the chilazon. And bidamo tzovin tcheles, that its blood is used to, so tzov in tcheles, it's used to dye those dyed strings which are called tcheles, the blue dyed wool. It's made with the blood of the chilazon, lefichach dam av yikarim, and therefore its cost is very expensive. The Rashi points out that the language of the Braisa is a little bit out of order. We really want to say because it only comes out of the ocean once every 70 years, therefore its cost is very expensive. But what the Braisa actually says is that because we use it for tcheles, the cost is very expensive. Right, so that's if you read the Braisa not like Rashi, that's what you would conclude, that because... Or you have one second, you're interesting, you're saying even with Rashi, that just because it came once every 70 years, that wouldn't make it so expensive. But because everyone needs it for tcheles, put the two of them together, and you end up with a very expensive commodity. If the people who think that they know what it is nowadays are correct, then it's not a kosher animal. Yeah. Why can't we have treif blood on our tzitzis? So the first, like by tefillin, there's gzeiras hakasov. It says leman tia toras Hashem beficha, right? That it has to be min amutar beficha. So by tefillin, there's gzeiras hakasov. Tefillin can only be manufactured from a kosher animal, but by tzitzis, there is no such. So I'm not sure inherently what the problem would be with so one second. So you're talking about something else. That the Gemara in Psachim says that when you have something which is not kosher to eat, so you're not supposed to do business with it either. This was a big shaila, apparently in Italy, in the 17th or 18th century. So there was one of the big hot item commodities were salted eels. And there was a big trade between Italy and Egypt where barrels and barrels of salted eels were being shipped, and the Shaila came up and was sent to the Gedolei HaPoskim of that generation whether Jews were allowed to get in on the business of salted eels. On the one hand, right, they're not buying it to eat, they're buying it to sell and to, you know, to make profit on, but on the other hand, it's a non-kosher animal, and you know, so it comes up there. It also came up, I think, even in 19th century United States about people who were in the fur trade, and they bought animals and they were selling the furs, which was not a problem, I think, but the meat, right? There was a lot of leftover meat after they skinned the animals for the fur, and they wanted to know if they were allowed to sell the leftover meat to non-Jews or to non-kosher restaurants, or whether that would constitute a prohibition. Now, the question becomes, that if, the way that you're saying it, what about the fur itself?
Well, that's the best fry. Well, the strimer made that from the sable.
My answer. There are those though who are still who are still a little bit bothered by this, you know, we're using treif animal for a mitzvah, and so they make an interesting observation. They want to say along the lines of the bee suggestion that the blood of the chilazon, there's a big question about whether the blood that we use for dyeing the tzitzis is circulated through the body of the chilazon in the way that normal blood is circulated through normal bodies. And the Gemara has this concept that there's two different types of circulation. One of them is called a mifkad pakid, which means that there may be like an animal or a creature that's created, right, with like a little pool of blood, but it's standing still blood. It's not blood that's being circulated throughout the queen's body, and then there's the blood which is being circulated, that's called the chabure michbar. It's blood which is connected, which is an intrinsic, an essential part of the body of a given creature. The Gemara even tells us that blood which is mifkad pakid, there's no problem of taking that blood out on Shabbos, because the only problem on Shabbos of netilas neshama, of taking blood from an animal, is if you're taking blood away from the circulation around that animal. But if the blood is mifkad pakid, so then potentially there would be no problem. And there are sources that seem to indicate that perhaps the blood of the chilazon is mifkad pakid blood. It's non-circulating blood. It's on reserve, right, if you will. And
it's
therefore
coursing through the body.
Exactly. And if that's the case, some people want to suggest that it's almost as if God created a packet of kosher blood inside of a non-kosher animal. They want to argue that it's not really part of the animal, it's just like something that God created inside of the animal. The animal is all around it, but it's not an essential part of the animal, and therefore it remains kosher.
The same way we are allowed to eat honey.
That's what Mr. Tannenbaum pointed out as well. At the honey, but the honey from the bees is a little bit—it's different for a couple of reasons. But over here, the argument would be that this blood, I think, it would be more similar to something else. It would be more similar to something like a tzoa, right? Which is also kosher, even if it comes from a non-kosher animal, because fundamentally we view it as a foreign substance inside, right, the body of the animal, rather than as part and parcel of the animal. Now, of course, that's foreign substance because it comes from food which the animal eats, and it wasn't ever part of the animal to begin with. This blood was created together with the animal, but nonetheless, there are those who argue that it is a foreign substance and therefore does not have the non-kosher designation, right, that the chilazon itself, if the chilazon is non-kosher, has.
Is the chilazon used to crack rocks?
That's something else. That's called the
shamir.
The shamir. Yeah.
Ah, made a mistake.
Yeah. All of these, you know, mystical creatures, or not mythical, but mystical, whatever. They're, yeah. So
life is
don't try to eat it.
Yeah, but mysterious. Mysterious is really what I want to say. Yes.
Very good.
It could have been a bit of a fish eye or something. Why did it have to be this way?
Why did God require us to use something so expensive for tcheles? So just first of all, the archaeologists point out that in ancient Rome and in other ancient cultures, tcheles was restricted to the royal class. That was considered to be the big day malchus, the imperial
royal
color. Exactly, royal blue. And the part of the reason for this was because Tcheles, right, is the most expensive. Keep in mind, the Mishnah Berurah says, right, that that the Tcheles is like a badge of honor. It's like a medal, right? We saw someone had the picture of the president of South Korea, North Korea, right, with all those medals, right, on his suit. So the tzitzis are like a medal, and so it's appropriate if the tzitzis have a royal color on them. A person's going to spend money on a fancy suit, they'll spend money on a fancy hat. So the tcheles is a medal from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, medal of honor.
Chur karpasus tcheles, achuz b'chav
levutz v'argaman, al galilei chesef, amudei sheish. Yes, so then there's a second reason the Gemara asks, why did the Torah choose tcheles, right, over all the other colors? And the Gemara answered, it's because the tcheles, right, reminds us of the Kisei HaKavod ultimately, and it represents the fact that the Jews are carrying God's Kisei HaKavod on their shoulders, so to speak. That when we act properly, so then God's reputation, you know, rises in esteem. God goes up in the polls, and whatever values God stands for goes up as well. When the Jews don't act properly, chas v'shalom, so then God's ratings in the polls go down. And the tcheles reminds us of that. That every moment that we're wearing it, we remember that the Kisei HaKavod, right, is riding on our shoulders. Okay, so that is. It depends on multiple variables. I mean, if you go through the siman, non-kosher animals for business, right? Can a person do business with non-kosher?
I heard years ago that a Jew is not allowed to, a butcher, not allowed to be involved with non-kosher animals. Is what I heard years ago.
Yeah. So that is the basic halacha. The Gemara says anything which the Torah tells us. Right, lo tochal. There's no bona fide iser hana, but nonetheless, there is a halacha that says lo tochal means you also shouldn't do business with it. And however, there are five or six exceptions, and it's those exceptions which one has to know how to apply or not to apply. So that's
complicated as horse thieves.
What?
Jews were known as horse thieves.
Again, there's no problem with a live non-kosher animal. A person's going to have a farm, right, and they want to have breed horses. Right, so that's why the same way there's no problem with the fur, right? The fur is not a problem because the fur is not kosher. Because if that were the case, you wouldn't be allowed to have live eiver min achai. Right, every live animal is eiver min achai. So you're going to tell me you can't do business with live animals even if they're from a kosher species? So the point there's a restriction. It's limited in terms of what we're not allowed to do business with. But it's a big sugya. Maybe we can talk about it sometime in the future because it's a very fun sugya to go through, and it actually takes us through a lot of different parts of Jewish history where Jews had questions about what type of businesses they were allowed to be involved with and how they were allowed to maximize their profits. And I remember I first looked into it when somebody asked me whether they're allowed to be a waiter in Domino's Pizza. So that was the question over there. They're going to be serving people non-kosher pizza, right? The whole day. That's going to be their income. They wanted to know whether that was halakhically permitted or not. What? Let's assume that all their clients or customers are not Jewish. So then it wouldn't be lifnei either. If they did have Jewish customers, so then you would get into questions. Chari ver dinar, trei avri dinar. But yeah, it's a good point. Okay, that's another interesting sugya to discuss. So let's turn our attention back to tcheles now. We've ventured a little bit far afield, although for good cause. But let's turn our attention back to tcheles. So Atanya, Amar Rabbi Nasan, Ein lecha kol mitzvah kala shaksuva b'Torah. There's no easy mitzvah in the Torah. She'ein matan schara ba'olam hazeh u'ba'olam haba. Even the simplest, the easiest mitzvah to perform will have reward in this world and in the world to come. But I don't know how much is the reward that a person has a right to expect in this world or the next. But sayulamadmi mitzvahs tzitzis. Take a look at tzitzis. The Gemara seems to assume that tzitzis is one of the easier mitzvos to fulfill. We're not necessarily talking about tzitzis with tcheles. We could just as easily be talking about tzitzis without tcheles. And we have a story about a person who fulfilled the mitzvah of tzitzis, and look at the tremendous reward that he got. Ma'isa ba'adam echa. There was a man. Shahaya zahir b'mitzvah tzitzis. He was very careful about tzitzis. Now keep in mind, the post can point out that when we say mitzvah kala, an easy mitzvah, right, the reward is immeasurable. So we see that there are many people who observe many mitzvos, and they're not going to get the type of reward that the protagonist in this story received. And so people are troubled. What do you mean? Let's go look and see if this guy got so much for his mitzvah of tzitzis, why don't we get so much for our mitzvah of tzitzis? And to that they point out to this word, Haya Zahir b'mitzvah tzitzis. He was careful about the mitzvah of tzitzis. Zihiros, you could see the Mesilas Yesharim's definition of Zihiros. You could check out the Marsha in Avodah Zarah's definition of Zihiros. But it implies something a little bit more than simply putting on tzitzis in the morning and mumbling a bracha and then continuing to wear it throughout the day. Zihiros would seem to imply a care that's manifest in putting on the tzitzis in a way that one takes pleasure from it and savoring the experience of putting it on and making the bracha and wearing it. Perhaps it would imply making sure to check the tzitzis, that it's there every once in a while, to check the knots before you put it on to make sure that they're intact. Perhaps it would imply that when one purchases tzitzis, one makes sure to purchase the tzitzis which are kosher and which one can use to fulfill the mitzvah according to all the different opinions. It may involve taking off the tzitzis as infrequently as possible, and similar things like that. So zahir doesn't mean the way that we all necessarily fulfill the mitzvah of tzitzis. Zahiris implies that if a person is very, very careful about the mitzvah, so then they can expect a similar type of reward that the protagonist in this story received. And from there we can generalize that if a person uses one mitzvah, right, doesn't have to be tzitzis, a mitzvah that speaks to their soul to be careful about, then they may receive a similar reward. The Rambam actually writes on the famous line in the Mishnah, Ratzah Kadosh Baruch Hu Lezakos Est Yisrael, Lefikach Hirba Lahem Torah Umitzvos, that God wanted the Jews to have merit, therefore He increased the Torah and the Mitzvos. So the Rambam makes a very similar point to this idea of Zihiros. He says that it's very difficult for people to feel an equal connection, an equal inspiration, an equal pick-me-up from all of the 613 mitzvos. But if God only gave us one mitzvah, don't eat from the fruit of that tree, so some people would have connected to it, and other people, perhaps, would not have connected to it, and those who didn't connect to that mitzvah would be left in the dark. They wouldn't have the opportunity to be zahir, right, in that mitzvah, and then they just would be left with a sort of a lukewarm type of spiritual existence. So what God did was He created enough mitzvos that there could still be a beautiful diversity, right, amongst, you know, the Jewish people's spiritual proclivities, but at the same time everyone will have at least one mitzvah that they can connect to very, very strongly. And and the Rambam says something astonishing. He says that it's that one mitzvah which will be a person's ticket to Olam Haba, meaning God looks for certain reserved, frequent, flyers, clubs or first-class lounges in Olam Haba. In order to get there, so you have to have fulfilled one mitzvah perfectly. Right? And so God made sure that there were enough mitzvos that everyone can do one of them perfectly, so that...
The man is imperfect.
The man. We're talking about the action. One action you can do perfectly. You are not perfect, but one action... You can be very, very mature. That's it. Give you one action. You can do that too. You can accomplish that.
Right. They talk about that in learning as well. They say that there are a number of great tzaddikim who are known to have chosen one masechta, and that is their heart masechta. That's the masechta that they choose to do all of their to know perfectly backwards, forwards, everything about it by heart. One masechta, not all of Shas necessarily, but if a person has one masechta, so that's going to be their ticket to the first class lounge, the same way that the Rambam says you need one mitzvah perfectly to get to that first class lounge. And that's what this Gemara is talking about also. Haya zahir b'mitzvah tzitzis. He was very careful that tzitzis was his soul mitzvah, his mitzvah neshama, and because of that, because he succeeded right in making a tzitzis, his soul mitzvah, because of that he received reward in this world, and he'll also get that much more in the world to come. So what exactly was his reward in this world? Shama sheyesh zona bekrachei hayam. He heard that there was a certain zona who lived far overseas. Now, so keep in mind, we're not talking about a person who is good with the other 612, but excels at tzitzis. We're talking about a person who's not so good at the other 612, but somehow he was able to really excel at the mitzvah of tzitzis. And so what's he doing with the other 612? He wants to find this zona, and she charges Nontelis Dalad Meo Zehuvim Bishara 400 gold coins for anybody who wants to be with her. So she gave La Arba Mea Zehuvim. He sent her the money and Kava La Zman, and they made up a time that they were going to have an appointment. Kishehi Giaz Mana, when his time came, Bav Yashav Ala Pesach. He came and he waited in her waiting room at the door of her room, and Nichnasa Shifchasa, her maid came in and said, Amra La Oto Adam Shashigelech Dalad Mea Zehuvim Bav Yashav Ala Pesach. That man who has an appointment with you is now waiting in the waiting room. So Amra he, she said, Yikanes, and we're building up the suspense with all of these dialogues. She said, let him come in, Nichnas, and he came in. Hitzielo Zayin Mitos Sheish, Zayin Mitos, she spread out seven beds, Sheish Shal Kesef, V'achas Shal Zav, six of them were made out of silver, one, the last one was made out of gold, Ubein Kol Achas V'achas,
all the way up.
Sulam Shal Kesef, there was a ladder of silver that connected right each of the beds, Ve'el Yona Shazav, and the top ladder was made out of gold, and also Ve'yashva Al Gabi El Yona Kishahi Aruma, she went and she sat on the upper bed, the seventh, the top bed, when she was Aruma, Ve'afhu Alali Shave Arom Kinegda, and he started to take off his clothing in order to go sit next to her. Bo Dalit Tzitziyota V'tafhulo Al Panav, his four tzitzis came and they slapped him on the face, the same way that you might get slapped in the face by the talis of the person in front of you when they're saying the bracha of lisatef batzitzis. Right, so, so the tzitzis came and they slapped him in the face, and as soon as that happened, right, don't take it lightly when that happens to you. It's a tremendous, powerful, exactly. Awakening. Right, what were you in the middle of davening when you got slapped in the face? It's not for nothing. So Nishmat, he slipped down off the ladders, V'yashavlo agabi karka, and he sat on the ground. He refused to continue his climb. V'afhi nishmat v'yashva agabi karka, so she came down off the top bed. She sat next to him on the ground. And Amra lo, she said, Apa shal Romi, by the whatever of Rome, eini manichacha, ad shetomarli mamum ra'isabi. I'm not gonna let you go until you tell me, like, why did you reject me? Right? What did you see that was wrong that led you to reject what I'm offering you? So Amar Lo, he said to her, that his version of an oath, ha'avodah, right, by God's service, shelo ra'isi isha yafa kamoseich, I've never seen as pretty a woman as you, but mitzvah achas tzivanu Hashem Elokeinu v'tzitzis shema, God gave us one mitzvah, and its name is tzitzis. Uksiv ba ani Hashem Elokeichem shtei pa'amim, and it says twice, ani Hashem Elokeichem asher utzei siyaschem yeres Mitzrayim liyos lachem lilukim ani Hashem Elokeichem. So that pasuk begins with ani Hashem Elokeichem and ends with ani Hashem Elokeichem, which is a literary device that the Chumash employs only rarely, and it's meant to grab our attention. And there's a special significance to the fact that this pasuk opens and closes with that same expression of ani Hashem Elokeichem.
Why does it say mitzvah achas? It should just say mitzvah, because it's one of Tayyad mitzvahs. Maybe the special mitzvah for him, but for him. What are we accomplishing by saying the word achas? Mitzvah.
Okay, so shalas chacham chatzi tshuva, right? You're suggesting that perhaps from his vantage point, right, he feels like he's got one mitzvah that he can connect with. So he says, God gave us one mitzvah, right? Meaning like, all the other mitzvahs, I don't, but this mitzvah, I get it. Right? Maybe, right? Does anyone, any other possibilities? It is a very interesting expression.
But that's a mitzvah that reminds about
600. beautiful, right? That the mitzvah of tzitzis we saw is connected to all the tayag. It's, we've got the number of the ksharim. It reminds us also, right? We saw a lot of sources that the tzitzis reminds us directly about Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, the Achdus Hashem, the fact that there's nothing in the world other than Hashem. There's a mystery. Right, there's a mystery. How does the world exist if God is all encompassing? Right, but the tzitzis reminds us of the achdus. As the Ramban says, that tzitzis comes techeles from kol, that God is all encompassing. And there are multiple other allusions, both in the number of the loops, right, which remind us of the gematrias of God's name, as well as the color of the techeles, which the Ramban also says alludes to the fact that that ultimately everything sort of melds or merges right into Kadosh Baruch Hu's Achdus. And so in that sense also, it's a mitzvah achas. It's one mitzvah which encompasses or is connected directly to all the other 612. It's also a mitzvah that reminds us of the achas, the one who's the ultimate one, the Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. Beautiful. I like that. So mitzvah achas, he said, we have this singular mitzvah which God commanded us, and in the parasha there is there is this literary device which the last pasuk begins with Ani Hashem Elokeichem and it ends with Ani Hashem Elokeichem. Ani u'shasili para, I am the one who's going to pay people back, right, for their sins. Ani u'shasili shalim sachar, and I am the one who's going to give reward. Now where do we see that in the Ani Hashem Elokeichem? Right, there is an interesting Hashem Yudke Vavke. What mida of God does that represent?
Rachamim.
That's the Rachamim. Right, Ani Ushasid. Right, Litain Sachar Elokeichem. That implies din. So you have two places: Ani Hashem Elokeichem, Ani Hashem Elokeichem. One of them, right, the Hashem perhaps is the one that's emphasized. And the other one, it's perhaps the Elokeichem that's emphasized. But it's both of them. It's the Rachamim and it's the Din, that God will give us the reward, God will give us the punishment, whichever one we choose to accept on ourselves through our actions. Achshav, and now, right, now that I was climbing up your ladder, Nidmu alai kedalet edim, I imagined them as four witnesses who are going to testify, not for me, but rather against me. I was being watched. The tzitzis were watching me. And I said to myself, I can't do this. I'm not going to commit such a crime when these tzitzis are going to report back to God and chas v'chalila lead to the puranus, the piraun, rather than the sachar. So the Zona said to him, Amra lo, eini manichacha, I'm not going to let you go. Ad shetomar li mashimcha, mashim ircho, mashim rabcho, mashim midrashcha. You've got to tell me, what's your name, where do you live, who is your rabbi, and what yeshiva do you learn in?
Told you she was Jewish.
She was not.
Why is she interested?
You'll see in a minute.
You want to send a refund.
You know, if you were saying Ma'amadot of Tehillim every Wednesday, you say this.
Mashim Midrashcha Shatala made bo Torah. What's the name of the yeshiva where you study Torah? Now I guess that either she had done her background research and she knew that he was Jewish and she was familiar with Jewish culture and she must have known that he studied in yeshiva, right? Or she figured if he's so much Yiras Shemayim, right, that he must be yeshiva bacher, right? Or perhaps he has so much knowledge, he knows how to make this beautiful drasha. Jewish, yes, but what? How does she know that he had a rabbi? How does she know that he learned in yeshiva? So Kasav v'nasan b'yada, he wrote it down on a paper, and he gave her the paper with all of the information. So Amda, she got up, v'chilka kol nichaseha, she divided all of her assets. Shlish l'malchus, one third she gave to the government in order to allow her to convert. Then shlish.
She
became Jewish. She was going to become Jewish, yes.
So?
But she was not Jewish.
But she became.
Oh my goodness.
Then she gave shlish laniyim, she gave one third to the poor, and shlish natla biyada, one third she took with her for travel expenses. Chutz mi otzan matzaot, with the exception, she didn't split up those beds and the linens. She didn't split those up. Those were, she took with her as well. So she took a little bit more than one third of her property with her, one third of her money, plus these linens and the beds. Ubas le beis midrasho shel Rabbi Achia. She came to the beis medrash of Rabbi Achia, which must have been where this Avrich told her that he was learning. Amralo, so she said to Rabbi Achia, Rabbi tzavei alai v'yasuni giores. Appoint a committee to convert me. Amarla, he said, Biti, Shema inayich nasata be'echa mina talmidim. Perhaps you're not a sincere convert. Perhaps you're only converting because you've fallen in love with one of my students. And then it would be a problem to convert you because we only accept people who are sincere converts, who convert because they want to join their destiny with that of the Jewish people, who convert because they want to serve God in the most elevated way possible, not people who convert for superficial or ulterior, yeah, I like that word better, for ulterior motives. So, Hotziah Ksav Miyada, she took out the paper with the name and the city and the Rebbe and the Beis Medrash, and Nasnalo, she gave it to Rabbi Achia, and she said, and
gave it.
She must have told him the story also, right?
I think he got the message.
So Amarla, he said, Lechi Zechi B'mekcheich, go get what you deserve. Right? In other words, you've shown tremendous mesiras nefesh, because you too were inspired, right, by the mitzvah of tzitzis, and now you certainly may join the community and marry this boy. So Osan Matzaos Itzialo Beisur, those linens which she spread on the beds to do an Aveira with him, Itzialo Beheter, now she made them her marriage sheets, and she was able to do the same thing, Beheter, and Ze Matan Scharo Beolam Hazeh, this is, we can see, a person who has Zehirus in Tzitzis, can certainly expect, if they need to receive this type of reward in Olam Hazeh. The Olam Haba, Ini Yodea Kama, and when we talk about Olam Haba, which is always much more, so I don't even know how to describe how much reward comes in Olam Haba. So that's the story. What's the hidden meaning of the seven beds? We know that seven is a very important number. Right, all over. Right, the Maral always talks about seven, right, as representing lemala min ateva, something.
Eight is
something.
Eight is the lemala min
ateva. Well, seven and eight are both lemala min ateva, depending on how you count.
Yeah.
Right, because I always had trouble with the eight. The seven makes much more sense to me, because if you assume that nature is represented, right, by the three dimensions in which we live, so then six is a number which represents the three dimensions, I always felt, much more directly seven, because a cube has six sides, and in the six sides of a cube you can envision the world that we live in, right, as a cube, six-sided cube. I think we talked about this, once before earlier, and so the seventh already, right, might represent something which is outside of the cube, it's outside of the planes, the six planes which form the cube. So I think last time we spoke about this, somebody said, yeah, but the center of the cube is also counts. In other words, but then we had a problem because the cube, even though it has six planes, has more than six vertices, right? Because the cube has eight vertices. So if you're talking about points, so then really the key should either be eight or nine are nature, and ten would be lemala min hateva. So, but I believe that the Maral does say that both seven and eight represent in different ways, right, lemala min hateva, and so there may be an indication over here, similar to what the Gemara says in Kiddushin, that the Yetzer Hara sometimes is too strong naturally for a person to overcome, but if they merit, because of their mitzvos, they merit some sort of a supernatural intervention, so that's what's going to enable them, to overcome, and perhaps the reward then also is a supernatural type of reward. It's not necessarily b'derech hateva that this person should get what he wanted without having to transgress the iser. But again, perhaps the whole idea here that it's the malam hateva. It could be that there's other things as well. Right? Shava brachos, right? We know that seven also has to do with marriage, malei shivu azos, So perhaps there's we're just trying to strengthen the theme over here that we have to figure out how to do it exactly. Someone else had a suggestion?
Shabbos, Shemitah.
Yeah, Shabbos and Shemitah. Again, are those you know the spitz of nature, or are those the beginning of super nature? That I'm not sure. Yeah.
Yes, they don't do that. They don't do it with Fadim too.
I think they say a story with her Moshe Feinstein that one time there was a woman and she was in Aguna and she wanted to get a heter to get remarried. She met a nice gentleman and she wanted to marry him. So she went, I think, to her Moshe Feinstein. And she said to him, you know, my husband divorced me in such and such a beastin back in Europe before the war. She was in Aguna on account of the war. So I think that Ramosha said to her, he said, you know that at a wedding, so the bride goes 7 times around the groom, right, walking, always following her right hand 7 times around the groom. And at a divorce, so the bride is supposed to walk 7 times in the other direction around the groom to symbolize. But not all courts that do divorces know this, he said. So I want to make sure that you did this. And she said, oh yes, I definitely did it. So he said, you liar, because nobody does that. So, anyhow. So, definitely the number 7 is very closely, very, very closely connected to marriage, right? And that's also, it's worth thinking about what is exactly the symbolic connection, right, between marriage and the number 7.
Perfection. So she is a really top notch. She is at the top. She is the perfection. Just like in the world there's a perfection of Sheva, maybe. So she was considered the top. You got to pay the top dollar, and therefore you got to go to the top.
So who are you quoting? To Plato, Aristotle? It sounds more Platonic than Aristotelian. Right? But. The fact is that someone showed me one time that Plato has like a very he has a theory about supernatural phenomenon which is very, very similar to what we're familiar with the spheros. And I remember also one time a musician told me that for centuries the musicians used to believe that there were a certain number of, well, I don't know whether they're pitches or tones or whatever it was, that there were 7 of them that corresponded somehow also to this idea, right, of perfection. So again, you could talk about the woman. It's not just a coincidence that she chose a number of 7, but the number 7 may have had some sort of a connotation even amongst ancient pagans, and that may be why she chose the number 7. But in terms of your question, though, about what could she have known? Right, this was not the heter, this was the iser. So I would say gamezelu mazel asah Elokim, that God makes, right, good and evil are always evenly balanced. And so for every possible act of good, there's a correspondingly powerful or not powerful act of evil. And so this woman may have been the antithesis of the kedusha of marriage. And in order to underscore that, she used to do this, with sevens, right? Particularly because that was the dark side, right, of marriage, if you will. And in the Zichus of Tzitzis, what he was able to do was vanquish, right, the dark side of marriage and convert it, right, to being a holy and sacred and blessed relationship. So maybe that's what's happening there.
There's one thing I learned this Gemara before, but I didn't understand. It has nothing to do with Tzitzis. The Gemara says, like Tishchatim, and Rabbi, I think it's Rabbi, says that you're not allowed to say how beautiful a non-Jew. So how did this guy say you're the most...
Was this guy a paragon of mitzvah observance?
No.
He was a paragon of tzitzis observance. But how is he allowed to go and pay the zona and expect to do what he was going to do with her in the first place?
But
he obviously...
From before and after. Now he's the paragon of virtue.
Oh, he became the tzitzis... Aha.
He remembered all the mitzvahs.
Let's move on.
I don't know. Because no one asked a question. So.
I know what somebody asked.
Right, no, but his question is as Lo Sechanim. Lo Sechanim, how can he compliment her? How can he say that she's so beautiful if she still isn't okay. Yeah.
And then I mean it could be we don't understand what that means.
Yeah.
Okay, so onwards. Amar Rav Yehuda, the first wide line now on Mem Daled Amud Aleph. Amar Rav Yehuda, talis she'ula, a talis which is borrowed, not yours. You're borrowing it from somebody else. Kol shloshim yom petura min tzitzis. The first 30 days, it is exempt from tzitzis. Mikan ve'ilach, from 30 days and onwards, it's chayaves. So this is this actually would seem to indicate, let's say...
I rent the house.
Hmm?
Okay,
so that we're gonna, that's the next line of Gemara. But here's a question. Right? The reason that we wear a talis for shachris is in order to take advantage of the opportunity to fulfill the mitzvah of tzitzis. Let's say that I forgot my talis at home, so I borrow my friend's talis. Am I fulfilling the mitzvah?
So you're only borrowing
the question is, you have your talis cotton on now. You didn't make a bracha on your talis cotton because you were holding it. You couldn't make it on your talis cotton.
Ooh, so that's another question. Can I make a bracha of lis'atif batzitzis on a talis that I borrowed? Right, that's not.
And then what do you do? Maybe you should make it on your talis cotton in that case.
Yeah, I guess if you're.
So
if you're borrowing a talis, and maybe it goes without saying, or perhaps it ought to be articulated, I'm not borrowing your talis. I am asking you to give me your talis as a gift, right? So it becomes mine, and I promise I'll give it back to you. But it needs to be mine if I'm going to make a bracha on it, if I'm going to fulfill the mitzvah. Just borrowing a talis, it sounds like a person will not feel, it definitely will make him feel more dignified during davening, may help him concentrate better during davening, but in order to fulfill the mitzvah of tzitzis, the talis must be yours.
What if he gives it to him? I mean, if somebody's borrowing a talis, it's obvious he's not going to use it to wipe his car with it.
So you're saying it goes without
saying. It goes without saying that he's giving it to him because he knows he's going to use it for a mitzvah.
Yeah, I remember in tenth grade. So we were doing a sugya. We were learning Maseches Gittin, but somehow there was a sugya about lending and borrowing. And my 10th grade rabbi was exceptionally clear. And so this particular sugya stands out because all of us were very confused. He started out the sugya by telling us about the Brooklyn Barrow. And he said that here in Queens, right, when we say borrow, we mean, can you please give me something that I can use? But in Brooklyn, he said, they say, let me borrow you something. In other words, use the word borrow in place of lend. And that was just the end of it, because for the rest of the sugya, we had no clue when he was saying borrow, whether he was using the Brooklyn Barrow or whether he was using the Queens Barrow. Okay, so you're so Mr. Amster is suggesting that when I go over to somebody and I say, can I please borrow your talis, what I really mean is, can I please have your talis as a gift, and I promise I'll give it back. It doesn't need to be articulated. It goes without even saying, right? Because I'm borrowing it for the sake of fulfilling the mitzvah, and the only way that I can fulfill the mitzvah is if we understand that this is really a gift. Now, that may be true if you're talking about a learned audience. I'm not sure what happens if you're talking about an unlearned audience. So those, you know, people, the borrower won't know, the lender won't know that this is what needs to happen. And so can we assume that really what they mean to say is, I have no clue what I need to do in order to fulfill the mitzvah, but whatever it is, that's what I'd like you to, that's the right that I'd like you to grant me in my talis.
One old system. you have to look for another one, or could you use that?
Well, a talus that's missing a whole set of strings. No, that's possible.
Definitely you cannot use it.
Oh, but it's a talus shul. You're part of them sitzes.
Oh. Okay, so that's an interesting... There's a difference... There's a difference between the shul talus and the private talus. So you, if you want to borrow somebody else's talus that's missing a tzitzis, so then it would seem that that there is no problem. If you're borrowing it for very, very short term. The shul talisos are much more questionable because we assume that the shul talus belongs to the entire congregation. And so it's your talus, but it's a talus which you own in partnership together with the other members of the shul, or perhaps, right, because pretty much anyone in most shuls can come in and be a shliach tzibur and use the shul's talis, or, right, so perhaps the talis is considered to be owned in partnership by all Jews. Now, if that's the case, and this is a big shiloh that the Mishnah Berurah addresses, why don't we have to make a bracha? When we put on a shul talis, the person is a shliach tzibur from Mincha, putting on the shul talis, he should have to make a bracha. It's partially his.
In Aras Israel, they have two sets of talitim. The ones that are used for guests that come and they don't have a talis, it's called the shul talis. But there is a set specifically for Baalei Tefillah that it's she'ula mamash, that they can never say bracha on it. And the Rav say, do not say bracha on this talis. They are marked specifically.
If the guy uses it
for
30 days.
Yeah,
so what, it's owned by somebody out of the country?
It was done specifically.
They lent it to the shul.
If it's donated, it's not good. They lent it to the shul for specifically, so you shouldn't say, and that's why they are marked. And uh-huh. So if there is this mark, you don't say a bracha.
Right, so that's a very beautiful solution. You have somebody who has a private talis. He doesn't donate it to the shul, right, but he lends it to whoever the Baal Tefillah is. Now, again, if he lends it to the shul, that could still be a problem. Right. Because the shul is composed of all the shul's members, and once they've borrowed it for 30 days, so then, as we just read, right, kol shloshim yom it's peturim in atzitzis, but mikan ve'elach, more than 30 days, it's chayeves. So it must be that it's not on loan to the shul, but rather it is owned by its owner, right? But it's on loan to whoever happens to be the Baal Tefillah, right, for that tefillah, and then it goes off loan as soon as the Baal Tefillah takes it off, and then the next Baal Tefillah borrows it anew when he's ready to daven. That way nobody is going to be wearing it after the 30-day limit expires.
What do you do in this case? You have to look for another one.
Yeah.
Or do you
but don't put it back into the pie.
It is somebody.
No. A shul's talis might not be pater from tzitzis because a shul's talis is owned by all the members of the shul, including yourself. Right. But Mr. Tannenbaum is right. Show it to the gabbai. The gabbai will take care of it. The gabbai will take care of it. So that we have talis shula is pater by min tzitzis. And Tanya Nami Haki Abraisa seems to support this idea, which tells us Hadar be Pundaki Beretz Yisrael, a person who's staying in a hotel in Eretz Yisrael, Vasocher Bayis Bechutzlar, it's a person who's renting a home outside of Eretz Yisrael, Kol Shloshim Yom Patur Mina Mezuzah. The first 30 days, they don't need to have a mezuzah there, but Mikan Ve'elach, from 30 days and onwards, Chayav, they do need to put a mezuzah on the home that they're renting, or on the hotel room, right, that they are renting. Aval Asocher Bayis Be'Eretz Yisrael, a person who's renting a home in Eretz Yisrael, Osa Mezuzah La'alter, he should make a mezuzah right away, Mishum Yishuv the Eretz Yisrael, because we want to encourage Eretz Yisrael to be settled. If he makes a mezuzah right away, he's more likely to stay, and even if he doesn't stay, so it's more likely to attract somebody else, right, to come and rent out that house, as opposed to if it didn't have mezuzah, so then it would be a little bit harder to attract tenants. So that's Mishum Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, put the mezuzah on right away, in order to encourage people to settle in Eretz Yisrael.